Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. And how's it going out there, all my Bitcoiners? I hope you're well all around the world. Thanks for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Today, we sit down with Beggy Malobo. He's a South African Bitcoiner. He's studying economics, and he recently appeared in the documentary Banking on Africa. Every Bitcoiner should check it out. It's streaming on Amazon Prime. But first, before we get started, we're going to check in with Swan. You can get your auto-stacking on with Swan. It's the easiest place to auto-stack BTC in the United States, not to mention the most affordable. The process is simple. You auto-fund USD, auto-stack that BTC, and you can auto-withdraw your BTC to your own wallet. That's it. You can get going now. Use my ref link, swanbitcoin.com/Brady. To get $10 dropped into your account, you'll get those sweet, sweet bonus sats 30 days after your Bitcoin purchase is executed. Speaking of our referral program, we want you to join the Swan Force. You can sign up at swanbitcoin.com/enlist. You'll get a custom landing page with your avatar and message at the top. And get this, you will collect 0.25% of every Bitcoin purchase your referrals make for up to 3 years. You'll get a minimum of $5, but then you can keep stacking on top of that. It's an incredible deal. Get out there, shill Bitcoin, tell people to auto stack, send them to the Bitcoin-only exchange that you trust, Swan Bitcoin. Also wanted to mention, on the other podcast that I host for Swan, called Swan Signal, I'm really loving the format, y'all. It's amazing. We invite two Bitcoiners who have never or very rarely publicly appeared together. This makes for great discussions that are very unique in the Bitcoin space. I've been listening to Bitcoin podcasts for 3 years now, and the past two Swan Signal episodes in particular have been two of the best I've heard. It's different, you know, so I think it's a great addition to your podcast rotation. You can check it out at swansignalpodcast.com. and youtube.com/swansignal. Thanks as always to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. Subscribe to the LTBN feed for other great Bitcoin-only podcasts like Bitcoin und Co. with Anita Posh, Bitcoin Audible with our boy Guy Swan, and What Bitcoin Did with Peter McCormick. All right, here we go. I really enjoyed this conversation with Beggy Malobo. He's an economics student. He's an active Bitcoiner from South Africa. Beggy appears in the new Bitcoin documentary, Banking on Africa, which is a great, you should definitely check it out. It's on Amazon Prime, as I mentioned. Beggy discovered Austrian economics in high school and has gone on to study economics, albeit of the Keynesian variety, at university. But he describes how he studies Austrian economics on his own and talks about it with his friends. He discusses here the state of the economy and of Bitcoin in South Africa, talks about running a full node. We get into all sorts of stuff. It was really fun just to sit down and chat with Beggy. All right, it's time to dive in. All right, yeah, man, it's a crazy time in the world right now. How are you doing down in South Africa?
Well, in terms of school, it's hectic. All my exams got pushed until basically they got delayed, but work has been also hectic. In fact, we got, like, in terms of work, like, because I work part-time, we got a lot more busy during the whole COVID-19 thing. So my employer is a think tank, and we analyze risk in South Africa and globally. And so clients were uncertain as to what's happening. So they book us for briefings and stuff like that. And then, yeah, it's been getting crazy.
Yeah, man. How about, you know, aside from COVID stuff and all that, like, what's the situation in South Africa, like, economically speaking? Is there lots of money printing going on? Do you feel like you're sort of on the precipice of inflation? Or what are you expecting for, you know, South Africa?
Yeah, so in terms of money printing or monetary central bank intervention, essentially, our central bank has cut rates by, like, since the beginning of the year, by like 2.5%. Mm-hmm. And they also, there is the printing of money. They've printed money to buy government bonds, QE, in other words. Yeah, so I do see that as inflationary. Whether it will be hyperinflation, I don't know. That's something that I'm not quite sure yet. But I do suspect in a few years from now that we will be in a worse situation than what we are right now. Mainly because the deputy finance minister here in South Africa stated that the central bank should buy bonds, should buy government bonds, basically telling the central bank to print money to buy government bonds, which is inflationary.
Right.
So those are the things that I'm constantly worried about, the politicians interfering with central banking and all that.
What is the monetary history of South Africa? Do you guys have any experience with hyperinflation?
I don't think we have experienced hyperinflation, but we do have experience inflation. I mean, if we measure the rand according to the gold, the rand has lost about like 90% of its value.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say like we were like a Zimbabwe, but there's definitely currency debasement, and there's definitely a devaluation of the currency. That's for sure.
Over what time frame has that 90% devaluation happened? Would you say
time frame? I'd say for the past. No, sorry. Ever since the rand got created, which is about what, if I'm not mistaken, about what 60 years? 60 years or so? 70 years? Yeah.
I mean, it's all over the world. The dollar's purchasing power is down, you know, 90%+ against gold since the creation of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
All right. So set the scene for us for those who haven't watched the documentary yet, which you know, after listening to this interview, you should go check it out. It's on Amazon Prime right now. It's like, what, 45 minutes, an hour, something
like
that?
Yeah, like 45 minutes. Yeah. 45
totally
minutes.
Digestible. And it's just, you know, I think especially for us in the United States and just Western countries in general, I think it's really important to understand more what's going on in other parts of the world. It's sort of outside the bubble a bit. And, you know, Bitcoin and crypto in Africa is really interesting. I did talk with Ray Youssef. He's the CEO, founder of Paxful. And so I kind of started learning a bit more about what's going on with Bitcoin and crypto in Africa. And it seems, and of course, Jack Dorsey's, you know, very interested and encouraged about the future of Bitcoin in Africa. So certainly worth checking all that out. Set the scene on that, about that question, like that you asked, and like in the context for us.
Okay. Okay. So the scene really starts when I was introduced to economics in the 10th grade. That's when basically the big bang of like questions exploded in my mind.
Why? Because most of us go through this, and we just kind of like fed this economic dogma of Keynesian dogma. And very many are like have the presence of mind to really question that, right?
Yeah, like the person that actually influenced me to like start questioning was my economics teacher that introduced me to economics. He was a crazy gold bug. He was a Max Kaiser crazy with gold. So he was, I think it was 1 week where he was explaining central banking, and how he introduced the topic was, remember that 5 cent, which is a small fraction of the rand, 1 rand, that your parents used to tell you stories that they could buy a loaf of bread or a can of soft drink? Well, I'm going to explain which institutions are responsible for the devaluation of that currency, or the devaluation of the 5 cent. And he explained fractional reserve banking, central banking. And that basically started my whole quest of like asking question, like, what is this actually? Like, why do we need a central bank? What is fiat and all that? And he gave me resources to read, you know, such as like Mike Maloney, Gold and Silver. And Mike Maloney was basically stating that the Austrians was correct. Like, they were correct in terms of their analysis of economics and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I started to read Mises about in the 12th grade or my first year of university. And that's basically the background of like that core question, because I'm still studying economics, right? I'm a BCom economics student, but the course that I'm studying is Keynesian economics. And Keynesians view that in order for you to have economic growth, you need inflation, right? And which is a contradiction itself when you define economic growth. And so that's the background behind that question. I was like, okay, because what I saw was like economists really today, they compared to like most people in the Bitcoin space, they know more about like economics and money and the consequences of inflation more than the PhD economists such as like Paul Krugman, the likes of. And basically that's what encouraged me to like ask that question. Like, Yeah.
And what was the question?
Yeah. So the question was, I think I remember. I said to Darby Roetz, I'm not sure if you noticed, but a lot of people in the Bitcoin space, they know more about economics than like PhD economists or PhD students in university.
I love it.
And I said, this is because mainly because like these mainstream economists in like the university studying, they were not exposed to different schools of economic thought like the Austrian. And therefore, they do not question, like, why does the government control money? Why do they have to control money? And so my question to Davi Rutt was, like, what was his opinion on Bitcoin being used as an exit door to central banking and fictional reserve banking? That was my question.
Yeah, and what was the answer you got back?
He did not necessarily answer that. He said that... he said basically the most important school to basically learn in university is the school of individual freedom, something like that. Mm-hmm. And he said basically I was right that like students in universities are not exposed to other schools of thought, and they should be, such as the school of thought of freedom, something like that. He did not necessarily answer my question at that point, but later on, we had a conversation, and he basically agreed with me that he sees value in Bitcoin and all that.
Yeah. So what is the general perception of Bitcoin? Like, is it pretty broadly known, first of all, and like, secondly, like, understood, I guess? You know, obviously, like, somebody might know the word Bitcoin, but what is your like, assessment of how broadly it's understood in Africa, or in South Africa?
A lot of people know it, but I wouldn't say a lot of people actually understand it. If you asked me this question probably like 7 years ago or 5 years ago, I'd tell you that not like they don't even know it or they're not interested in it. But now I think there is interest because a lot of people are starting to see that a lot of stuff is getting more expensive. It's more expensive for them to go about their daily lives. Mm-hmm. And so there's an interest in a form of finding a store of value. So there's definitely interest. I wouldn't say there's widespread understanding, but there's definitely interest in Bitcoin, and I believe people will start to actually seek resources to understand Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, the store of value aspect is, you know, that's where we are now, and that's the obviously the like the selling point or the major attraction, because we're in a world where the money printers are just going off right now, and
yeah,
have been for a while. Going brr, exactly. And I love that meme, by the way. Like, we have Bitcoin down to like two memes. It's like brr and yeah. Bitcoin fixes this. You know, it's like that's all the combo of those. Yeah. That's Yeah. So, okay. So we're, you know, the store value is obviously where we're at now. That's the most attractive. It's not widespread enough at this point to really be a widely used medium of exchange. There are lots of, you know, I guess counter forces to adoption as a medium of exchange. I think the largest of which is in most countries. You know, Bitcoin is taxed as a commodity. So you sell some Bitcoin, you have to account for it on the tax front and, you know, pay 15%. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a big impediment. And then of course it's just not, you know, widespread enough. And people want to hold on to it because it's appreciated.
So,
I mean, the store of value thing is there. I see like inflation really driving up over time. Like the two problems that I noticed, and it's like a terrible combination. In fact, I saw somebody tweet earlier today about how the boomer generation, which is like people who are like upper 50s to their 70s, he was comparing, it was like they're more savers, right? And the younger generations, they're not interested in saving. They just like to spend. And I'm like, dude, it's not about like a generational like behavioral difference, right? It's about the fact that we've been living in a Keynesian age with money printers going off for, you know, our whole lives, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so then you have a twofold effect that's just punishing the younger people in this world. One is, you know, productivity continues to rise at the same rate that it was under a sound money standard because technology is improving. We're all getting more efficient. You know, capitalism's happening, but wages have gone stagnant for essentially for, you know, since in the United States since 1971, right? Since we went off the gold
standard. Since left the gold standard, yeah.
Exactly. So you have that happening. And then, which is all, you know, when it comes down to it, is basically a form of time theft because we're, you know, spending more time making less money. And then you have the monetary premium of all these assets, right? So all this money is getting printed. And these guys, you know, the boomer generation is the beneficiaries of like this cancel-on effect, right? They're close to the money because just by the fact of timing, right?
Yeah.
And then they put all their money into these relatively scarce assets. And then it's like, you can't buy a house, you know, because it's like they're using it as a store of values driving
value.
Prices. yeah. Right. Do you see that happening in South Africa too? I mean, you got to feel it as a younger person, I would imagine.
Yeah. And it goes to that point of what you said about central bank intervention. I mean, the thing about interest rates is that they play a very important role, right? If you cut interest rates, you are sort of also de-incentivizing savings, right?
Exactly, yeah.
The whole thing of time preference, right? Like for example, what the central bank here in South Africa did with the whole 2.5% cut in like the repo rate, which is the interest rate here in South Africa, that disincentivizes me from like saving. I see this because I think I was looking at commercial banks and what interest rate are they offering on their savings account, and it gets lower and lower every time they cut rates. So I'm less inclined to save. Whereas when I look at, if I look at it from the loan perspective, it's getting cheaper now to get a loan.
Yeah.
So I'm more incentivized to take on debt than I am to like save.
Right.
And there's great consequences for that in the future. I'm not saying I'm against debt, but I think we've sort of reached the point where it's becoming unsustainable now. Mm-hmm. Not only here, but also see that around the world as well. That's definitely something that I see here in South Africa. A lot of young individuals are not really focused much on savings. They're mostly focused more on accumulating debt.
Yeah. And then we, you know, as younger generations get blamed for being irresponsible and, you know, have this massive short-term time preference, right? Which just irritates.
Yeah.
The fuck out of me, to be quite honest, like to put it bluntly. I mean, anyway, so rant over on that front, but
I mean, it's also like a passion that I've noticed myself. Ever since I got into like Bitcoin, I've thinking about savings like almost constantly, compared to when I hold the rand. Like it's something that I've also noticed myself. I'm more inclined to save. It's not only about like savings. Even like my actions, I'm mostly concerned about, okay, what can I do right now that can improve my future self?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I spend a lot of time talking about this because I think it's absolutely fascinating. The simple change of the way that money works, right? The way that money that's driven our society works literally changes us as human beings, right? And as individuals. And then, you know, you accumulate that over across, you know, millions and hundreds of millions and billions of individuals. And what kind of society does that generate? This is the hope that Bitcoin brings, right? And I think it's something that you don't like understand until you've been in that rabbit hole for a little while, I think. It's one of the more advanced, like, I think, lessons that Bitcoin teaches, you know?
Yeah, it is. I've also seen this with my friends, actually. A lot of my friends are like either gold bugs or like crypto bugs, Bitcoin bugs, let me say. And I've seen this with them as well. It's not only that they save more, but the actions have changed now. They're mostly concerned about the future and how to like better themselves. So yeah, it's definitely a pattern that I've seen in terms of Bitcoin or sound money. In fact, not only Bitcoin, but like people that I see that are acquiring gold have a lower time preference compared to someone owning like the Rand and such.
If Bitcoin didn't exist, if we lived in a world without Bitcoin, you know, would do you think you'd be less hopeful about the future?
No, not at all. Not at all. Mainly because I'm always scared. Stressed, really. There's a move by the South African government to go to the printing press.
Yeah. Right?
They want to print money for their programs. And the consequences of that will be hyperinflation. Right. So I view Bitcoin as a choice. It's an exit door for me so that I can protect my store of value so that these people do not mess with my savings.
Yep.
So I would definitely not be hopeful if I didn't have Bitcoin at all.
Yeah, right?
unless gold existed as well, then okay, then I could see into acquiring gold as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, gold is natural money. Like, I think Bitcoin is natural money, meaning, you know, that markets for 5,000 years have been converging on gold as the best money, you know, just organically because, you know, of its sound money properties. But yeah, we've learned that gold is easily co-opted by central authorities. So could you see, you know, an outcome of let's assume Bitcoin doesn't exist. Do you think it's probable or not that governments could move back to a gold standard, you know, given that things get really bad with, you know, all the money printing that's going on?
I do not see that. I think once they have the ability to print money, they are a lot more incentivized to print more of it. Right. Even like Zimbabwe, look at Zimbabwe right now. They're not stopping to print money. They're still continuing printing a lot of money and a lot of it. So I do not see that happening where they get like complete control of the central bank and then there's like catastrophic hyperinflation and they suddenly stop.
Yeah.
I think it's up to like individuals to take away that power away from them rather than them taking it away from themselves.
Yeah. That Hayek quote, you know, it always comes back. I probably think about it like at least once a day or something. It's like, unless we can find some sly roundabout way to take back control of the money for the people,
Then
it's kind of hopeless because it's lost at this point. And the central banking cartel, for lack of a better word, right, has just so much control. And so even if there was like, you know, hyperinflation of the global reserve currency, I feel like, you know, we just move to some other currency like we have through history. Maybe it's like, you know, the RMB or something like that, or some other currency of a strong nation that hasn't hyperinflated.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll take over, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We've seen this, you know, movie play out many times throughout history. So, I mean, Bitcoin then, you know, has the properties that really improve on gold. In that sense, right? That it's much harder to centralize. Do you run a node yourself?
Oh yeah, this is something that I should explain as well. It's actually a lot expensive for like me to run a node, mainly because data prices here in South Africa are expensive. Mm-hmm. But I've recently installed fiber in my area, on my house, really. So it's now I'm going to actually look into running a full Bitcoin node. But nice. I couldn't before because like, data prices was just so expensive to run like a Bitcoin node.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we had this big battle, right? The scaling battle, you know? It's important to prioritize decentralization, which, you know, means that you need to be able to run a node as easily as possible. So that's good to hear. Have you looked into the specifics yet? Like, what are you, like, what's kind of the first thing that pops into your mind as the way for you to start up a node?
I think I saw someone doing a Bitcoin node using Raspberry.
Yeah.
And I thought that was super cool, mainly because I'm interested in coding as well. Like, I'm learning Python and all that.
Nice.
So I think as soon as I, like, get this fiber thing up and running, or else already up. But as soon as like this whole lockdown thing, I mean, has ended, then I could like buy a Raspberry and like operate a Bitcoin node. But it's always been like, ever since I think I started to like really deep dive into Bitcoin, I've always wanted to run a node. It's just like the cost of it is just like massive. But now with me working, it's going to be a lot more easier for me to do so.
Yeah. And there's some great software out there now too. I mean, if you wanted to play, if you wanted to start playing with it, you could just download Bitcoin Core onto your laptop or computer, or like there's this, some software called MyNode, which is really slick. Pierre Rochard has some software called Node Launcher that really makes it just a couple of clicks, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, building a Raspberry Pi and having a dedicated little box, I have a couple right here, is great. I definitely recommend it, because then you don't, like, your computer shuts on and off all the time, right? And then you're off the network, you're not syncing, and then when you turn it back on, you gotta like sync all the blocks you missed. So it's nice to have a little low energy consumption, cheap, relatively cheap, you know, device to run it. I definitely recommend that. But to play with it, it, you know, you could download one of those, some software, and just like, you know, get that experience. It's kind of a fun feeling, you know, as a Bitcoiner, to just like watch the blocks, you know, come in and the node sync up. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. So
I look forward to having that. Actually, I actually look forward to having a Bitcoin node. That whole experience, I've seen it like many times on YouTube, people setting up their nodes. It's like, damn, I wish this was me.
You get there. So what do you use to like store your Bitcoin now?
Yeah,
I mean, you don't have to get too specific, but I mean, do you like store it offline, like in a hardware wallet?
Hard wallet.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something I'm going to do, but okay. So let me tell you my purchasing of Bitcoin. I'm not going to go into like really specifics, but
right
now I'm just using Samurai Wallet, which allows me to have full control over my private keys. And once I have like enough Bitcoins that needs more security, then I'm going to buy like a hardware wallet, like a Ledger or Treasure, and store my Bitcoins there. But yeah, like right now I'm just using Samurai Wallet, or wallet that has like where I can have full control over my private keys. And that's it.
Right. And I mean, that's important, right? As Bitcoiners, I'm glad that, you know, like that you've understood that. And like, it's not something at Swan, we have a lot of kind of new coiners coming in, right? And kind of getting some of their first Bitcoin at Swan. And so it's interesting to kind of walk this line between, you know, the kind of the Bitcoin ideal Bitcoiner, right? These sort of ideals that we aspire to, like not your keys, not your coins, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think are really important. But it scares the shit out of new coiners, right? So we wrote an article about wallets, you know, and it was a collaboration between me and Brandon Quittam. He wrote most of it, and then we kind of like, you know, edited it together. And I had to make some more edits because we were getting support requests of people like, I thought this was supposed to be easy, but now I have to download this wallet and I have no idea what's going on. And you know, it's because like the title.
Now I have to write these 12 words and all
that. Yeah, they're like, what the hell? We're not used to, you know, having a bearer asset as money. The title of it was Bitcoin, not your Bitcoin wallets, not your keys, not your coins, right? And we were talking about like, you know, like exchange hacks and all this stuff. And just when I reread it from a new coiner perspective, because I'm just so, you know, entrenched in the Bitcoiner ideals now, I was like, oh man, this is terrifying. You know? So we had to rewrite it. And with basically the principle was like, you should hold your private keys when you're ready. Like when you're comfortable.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like I'm not going to tell my grandma to hold her private keys. It's going to be safer on an exchange and cold storage, you know? Mm. So, yeah.
Anyway. I think that was like the first lesson they taught me. So when I entered Bitcoin, I joined this Telegram group, very educational Telegram group on regarding Bitcoin in South Africa. And the first lesson they told me was that you should never keep your coins, your Bitcoins on an exchange. You should always move it to a wallet where you have full control over your over your private keys.
Yep.
Mainly because like exchanges get hacks and all that.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, it's absolutely true. It's just we can't scare away the new coiners, right, with things like that.
Yeah.
I think we need to get them in and sort of bring them along slowly. So, I mean, that's sort of our mission at Swan is like, you know, make Bitcoin feel doable, right?
We don't scare
you away, but we wanted to like educate you and make you comfortable with holding your own keys because you should do that. And like, the articles definitely says, you know, like when you're ready and we're here to get you ready, you should hold your own keys. That's, you know.
I think it's also like, it's a self-responsibility thing. A lot of people are not really used to it. Have money at the bank, you can always like go to the bank if something happens and they will correct it for you. But with this, that doesn't happen. So I think that's scary, like being fully responsible over like your own money. That's something that not a lot of people are used to.
Yeah, no one's used to it now. I mean, we've completely outsourced the control of our money to banks it's not, I mean, it's really not your money, right? It's not. I mean, it's the same principle as not your keys, not your coins. It's not your money.
Yeah.
It's the bank's money and they can dole it out as they see fit, right? I mean, if they're in a bad way, then they're going to start limiting withdrawals and
exactly.
Because they don't, it's not full reserve, you know?
Yeah. And I think so, we should also like, continue.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. You touched like on a very important point, the whole functioning of like fractional reserve banks. It's the very nature that when there's a crisis like COVID-19, they are extremely vulnerable to it. And so that's why I think that central banks have cut rates, because they're offering a form of cheaper source of credit for these commercial banks so that they do not like become bankrupt as such.
Insolvent, yeah.
Yeah.
It's that moral hazard. I mean, once they start on that down that path, you can't like stop it, right? You can't not bail people out.
Yeah. In fact, there was a bank here in South Africa last year that wasn't able to basically provide money on demand and had to like close down. What happened with this? That bank, I think they were committing essentially like fractional reserve banking. They did something with the money and they couldn't really pay the money back on demand. And they were, it was catastrophic because you saw like these long queues of elderly people, because it was, I think most of the clients were elderly individuals, right. And they couldn't get their funds out because this bank effed up, you know,
didn't have them.
it didn't have it.
I mean, that's the game. That's the game they're playing, right? I mean, they're like, all right, we have your money, right? So it's our money now. And what we're going to do as a business to make money for ourselves is use your money to give out loans, make interest on those loans, or, you know, even make more speculative bets. You know, with your money. It's a racket, man. It's a racket.
Yeah.
So, okay. I am interested in Paxful. Like I said, I spoke with Ray Youssef . I'm wondering, do you see Paxful being used in South Africa?
I haven't seen it. No, I haven't seen that being used in South Africa. No.
Yeah.
So
it's
far.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So where do you guys acquire Bitcoin? You have some popular exchanges.
Yeah, there's exchanges. The most popular one is Luno.
Yeah. Who sponsored the documentary, right?
Yeah, who sponsored the documentary. That's where most South Africans get their Bitcoin. But I usually like to look at various other exchanges here in South Africa. There's also another one called Ice Cubed. And so what I like to do is I like to look at which one is selling Bitcoin the cheapest. Mm-hmm. And that's what I use. I'm not loyal to any of them. I'm just loyal to Bitcoin, and whoever sells it the cheapest, I'm going there.
Yeah. So you're using Samurai. Do you use CoinJoin as well?
Oh, not yet. No. Mainly because I still have a lot of research to do that, to basically understand CoinJoin. But that's definitely something that I need to look at. I mean, I need to take care of my privacy as well.
Yeah. Do you, so I assume your exchanges obviously have like, there's some kind of KYC laws.
Yeah, there is.
Follow, right?
Yeah.
So have you looked at like local Bitcoins or like Bitcoin ATMs or something to try to get anonymous, buy Bitcoin anonymously?
There is, I haven't used it. I haven't used local Bitcoins, but I did see a Bitcoin ATM in Sandton, which is like basically the business hub of South Africa. It was so cool. It's in this like shopping mall. It's like this ATM, this big ATM where you can like just deposit your fiat and get like Bitcoin and stuff. But I haven't used it yet.
Yeah.
There's
a big premium on them, but
yeah. That's another thing. There's like a huge premium on them. So I was like, no.
Yeah. Because they're more private. So yeah, it makes sense.
So in terms of like the whole Samurai Wallet thing was, when I started getting into Bitcoin, I was like a student, like really student. So I wasn't like earning like a lot of money for me to basically acquire a hardware wallet. But now since I work like part-time, there's definitely a case for me to like get a hardware wallet and also look into doing coin drain and such. But right now, the most important thing for me is like getting my money away from fiat as soon as possible. And then I'll deal with the hardware wallet aspect of it. But that's also important. But I'd say if I were to rank it, first thing would be store value. Second thing would be privacy. And then the third thing would be, I'd say, self-responsibility over my savings.
Right on. That makes sense. So let's dive back into your work, like what you're doing part-time. Yeah. I know you're still at university right now, right?
Yeah, I'm still at university studying BCom, Keynesian economics.
Right. Are you undergrad?
Yeah, I'm an undergrad. I'm in my final year now.
Cool.
I'm in my undergrad studying Keynesian economics. Mainly the reason why I'm studying Keynesian economics is just really to understand what are these crazy people saying.
Yeah. Do you talk to your fellow students or professors about like Mises and Rothbard, et cetera?
Excuse me. I do to my friends, not to my professors. So the reason why I don't talk to my professors about Bitcoin is because we had a class this other last year or so. This other year. And the topic was Bitcoin, right? And my professor stated that Bitcoin cannot be money because it's unstable. And the whole reason why fiat is stable is because they have a central bank behind it. Mm-hmm. And so I raised my question up. I was like, yeah, but like Zimbabwe had a central bank behind it. Look what happened.
Yeah.
And I was, that professor did not receive that well. So I was like, maybe I shouldn't do this. Professors should rather do that to like my friends, but like my friends are like hugely inspired by Rothbard, and like most of them are anarchists, so they do buy Bitcoin, and well, some of them do buy gold if they're not really into Bitcoin. So yeah, so I do talk about this a lot to my friends as well.
Probably smart move.
Sorry, yeah, continue.
I'm just gonna say, probably a smart move not to go into it with your professors, since they're like controlling your grades, etc. Right? Yeah. Like, this guy is hopeless. He's lost. He's a lost cause.
He's lost. So I was like, no. Yeah, so I don't have these types of like debates with like my professors. I just listen to them contradict themselves. That's it.
Yeah. And just kind of like smile to yourself, like,
yeah,
I know the truth. I know more than you.
Yeah. I mean, I think when was this? I think it was last year. We were discussing sustainable economic growth, and my professor saying that, no, we need like government involved in fiscal policy, and we need a central bank involved in monetary policy, because there are all these booms and busts.
That's
happening. And I asked, like, okay, so what causes these booms and busts? They can't answer you. If you were asking John Maynard Keynes, he'd tell you it's animal spirits. But the professors themselves, they just say it just happens. Like, and that's why we have like central banking and fractional reserve bank, I mean, and governments being involved in in fiscal stimulus and all that. And so when I look into Mises, they explain that, no, it's actually the central banks that are and governments that are causing these booms and busts in the economy.
Yeah. So I mean, I think there are natural capitalist cycles, right? They need to happen to clear out, you know, malinvestment and exactly. to make space for, entrepreneurs who have a better understanding about what the market wants, et cetera. And if you let that happen naturally, the cycle's going to happen, but it'll self-correct, and it won't be nearly as big. So when you start, trying to control the economy, which is absolutely arrogant, that humans, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, we are extremely arrogant thinking that they can control, this incredibly complex organic system. No, that doesn't happen. And when you try to control the price of money, then you're affecting the price of goods and services throughout the entire economy. So signals can't be sent to the, entrepreneurs, et cetera. So, I mean, you know this whole story, and it's just a mess. It's just a mess. And so what happens is, you get progressively, you kick the can down the road, you get progressively larger and larger busts, right? And you run out of tools to be able to create the boom cycle again. And it blows up.
Exactly. I mean, in the context of what's currently happening right now with the whole central planning, look at like what governments around the world are doing, imposing lockdowns and basically defining which business should operate essential and versus another business that should not operate non-essential. But it's like what you said, like market is highly complex. Each business relies on each other in order for it to operate. So you have this business that it's allowed to operate, and it needs some resources from this other business that's not allowed to operate. So now it can't operate by itself.
Right.
So it's absolutely crazy, man.
It is. It's insanity. But I think, I think the jig is up. These Engel bugs and Austrians have been talking about this, had this understanding for a long time, and have been predicting the kind of final, what they called the crack up boom, right? Of this, of this process, of this, just like Frankenstein's monster of an economy that we created. It's now, it's now gone global. I think with this pandemic situation that we've really accelerated or pulled that forward. I think that, I think there was a crash coming at some point in the next few years, probably just as the kind of natural cycle that this fiat kind of system puts us into. But I think, probably could have papered over it again for at least another 10, 20 years, right?
Yeah, there's this smart economist here in South Africa by the name of Russell Lamberti. He's also like an Austrian economist. Mm-hmm. And he basically stated that the COVID-19 pandemic, or rather the response to COVID-19 by governments and central banks, is a trend accelerator. It's mainly accelerating us to that point of more money printing, higher debt levels, deficit spending, and all that. It hasn't changed. It's still that.
Yeah.
Just on a bigger scale. I mean, it's crazy. In the U.S., I saw like the $2 trillion stimulus package. And I was like, this is the biggest stimulus package in the world. That's what the politician would say. I was saying like, wow, this is the biggest welfare transfer I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. And it's, some of it came directly to people, but most of it goes to the big banks and the corporations and to try, because like you were talking about earlier, they're operating fractional reserves. So when, in times of crisis, people want their cash, right? And so to try to stave off that kind of situation, the run of bank situation, they're just giving out liquidity. Boom, take it. Give their money back to them, right? it's mostly corporations who are in trouble, right? Because they're also like operating on debt they're not saving either. Why would you? It's just not a smart business decision.
Yeah, it's cheaper to get debt. Why not?
Exactly. So it's just the whole thing's fragile. I've heard, I think Travis Kling is credited with kind of coming up with this term, but it's corporate socialism,
In
a sense, right? Everything's getting bailed out. They're giving money to stay afloat.
I see that. Yeah. Corporate socialism. Yeah. I think that's the first time I've heard it, but I think I understand the point where like the businesses that are close to government and close to like the central bank, they're the ones that get bailouts, but the small ones, they really don't get that. Now, seeing that also here in South Africa, the politicians here, they view certain businesses as they are too big to fail, particularly the ones that are owned by the government. Like, for example, we have a Eskom, which is essentially a company that distributes electricity in South Africa, produces and distributes electricity in South Africa. They have a monopoly of production of electricity in South Africa. And so they're hugely in debt, and they're not allowed to fail. And so they're constantly getting these bailouts. But yeah, it happens every 2 years that there was some issue and they need another bailout. There's another issue and they need another bailout.
Exactly.
And we have, and it's not to say with every bailout they're getting better. They're getting much worse. We're getting a lot more power outages, a lot more than before. So things just getting worse and worse and worse. And that's something that I do see will happen in the future as well, if they don't allow this thing to fail and just allow private individuals to just take over.
Right. And the message you're sending is, you know, you don't have to make sound business decisions. You're never going to go out of business. So you can be as reckless as you want, and we're here to backstop you.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, you could like steal money and still get a bailout. That's what happened to some of these guys from Eskom. They stole money and still getting bailouts.
You don't need to provide an actual, like, you know, reliable service because, you know, we're here to bail you out.
Yeah.
Have you thought much about, you know, a transition away from a fiat world to a sound money world? Like, from, like, what do you think would look like, the transition period? Do you think it's like, are you nervous or pessimistic about that period, and then ultimately optimistic?
I am. I think I am optimistic. I just don't know how it will look like. But I do see that. I do see some aspects of like the privatization of like everything, or like here in South Africa, the government does not necessarily have monopoly of force. You can get like a private security company to like protect your property and such.
Mm-hmm.
So. And it's working quite well, actually. So I'm very optimistic of a sound money society, right? Yeah, so I'm optimistic. I wouldn't say I'm pessimistic.
But yeah, but actually, what about the transition, though, to that? I mean,
transition.
Yeah, like, have you thought much about that? Like, it seems to me that there can't be a transition without some pain, right? Like, what happens?
Yeah.
How does it work? You know. How do we move to pricing everything in Bitcoin? There's so much debt out there. How do we like end up getting to like the true value of products and services, you know, without hurting a lot of people?
Yeah, I think you touched on something very important there. And it's actually also scary, honestly, because in order for us to move to that point, a lot of things need to fail.
That means
a lot of people are going to lose their jobs.
Yeah.
And that's something extremely scary. So the transition for me, I'd say it's a scary point, but I view it as something very necessary, something that needs to happen.
Yep. The fire must happen.
Yeah.
And unfortunately,
it's scary.
Yeah, it is. It is really scary. Yeah, but like, you know, it's completely the fault of central banking and that whole policy. I mean, it's just creating this situation where the only way out is a massive, massive, you know, just like global fire situation.
Yeah.
And it's going to be tough because, you know, you put people out of work for a long time. Obviously people get desperate, and then there's all kinds of civil unrest, and countries will fail,
exactly.
And it'll be extremely volatile. Fortunately we have Bitcoin, right? Cause otherwise there's like no ray of hope, really. Cause how do you, you know, what system do you move to after that? I mean, I guess they'd figure something out. People would figure something out. These bankers would, and I'm sure it would be in, you know, to their benefit again. But with Bitcoin, we as individuals have an option to move. We're not like powerless, right?
Exactly.
In the way a new money is decided upon. So yeah, I mean, I think the best thing that could happen is we'll see, you know, just kind of a rebirth of the global economy based on the ingenuity of humans that have been sort of, I guess, their passions and their ingenuity has been sort of stifled by the system we're living in now. And so then there will be all this opportunity to, for these little kind of seedlings to pop up, and it'll be like a kind of a grassroots, literally, emergence of a new economy based on Bitcoin.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it may actually take time for us to reach that point. It's definitely something scary, but it's also, I'm also hopeful about it because I have Bitcoin. Like it's what I said, man. If I didn't have Bitcoin, jeez, I would be hella stressed. I think that's what I also mentioned in the documentary. Because I'm seeing this approach by the South African government to move closer and closer to the central bank. Mm-hmm. So in South Africa, there is some form of independence of the central bank. They can't just like print money by order of the ruling government. Mm-hmm. Now I've seen like certain deputy ministers stating that no, they should print more, certain government officials stating that they should print more money. And it's something that definitely scares me. But I'm less scared now since I have like Bitcoin and all that. The transition will definitely be scary. I see it as something that's very necessary to happen, but I am hopeful that I have something that can sort of in a way protect me.
Yeah, we have Bitcoin and we have each other, and I think we'll, you know, see a return to community-based care for one another, right? Not a reliance on corporations or states to take care of people in need. It'll be the family and friends and communities around us that will, you know, support people, and there'll be just a kind of human nature. I think the good sides of human nature will assert itself alongside the vile parts of us. But I'm a general optimist too, and I think in a situation like that, care for our fellow friends and family and community members will prevail. And like I said, we'll have Bitcoin to transact with, you know, so we can, render goods and services to each other and use Bitcoin. And that's sort of the way the new economy will start to grow and flourish. And I think it's a beautiful world, man.
Yeah, it is. It is, man. I agree with you.
Yeah, man. All right. Well, this has been a ton of fun. Do you have anything you want to close up with, some like closing words or closing thoughts for Bitcoiners or South Africans or just listeners around the world?
Before I close my words, it's like, what do your listeners want to hear? Because I thought that they may be interested in hearing like, okay, there's this guy from like South Africa, an emerging economy, like how does he like necessarily view Bitcoin? Mm-hmm. And my view for Bitcoin, and I think a lot of South Africans will view Bitcoin, is it's a choice, right? It's an option for us to basically opt out. Mm-hmm. Right? When you see central banks cut rates, when you see them printing money to buy government bonds, all of that stuff is inflationary. That means that the standards of living is going to get worse and worse in terms of like the prices of goods and services will get more expensive over mm-hmm. time. So a lot of South Africans are looking for a store of value. It could be Bitcoin, it could be gold. I do not know right now, but I think the answer will become more clearer in the future. Perhaps maybe if I were to put a time frame on it, and I don't really like putting time frames on things, but I'd say the next probably 3-5 years, I think I'll see a more interest in Bitcoin or sound money from ordinary South Africans.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my closing point. Essentially.
All right. Yeah. Awesome, man. I really appreciate it. So what's your Twitter handle so Bitcoin Twitter can start hitting you up when they listen to this?
Yeah. So my handle is Mahlobo, MAHLOBO _ Beki, BHEKI. You can find me. I'm currently on a break on Twitter because my schedule is so hectic with work and school, but I haven't tweeted.
Twitter's like a job.
Yeah.
Itself.
Yeah, but yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show, Brandy. Sorry, Brady. Sorry.
It's okay.
Brandy. I'm just thinking of alcohol now.
It's all good, man.
Mainly because alcohol was illegal here, dude. Like under the lockdown, it was illegal to get alcohol. So
was it really?
Yeah, dude, they banned a lot of stuff. They banned e-commerce at a certain point because it was unfair. Yeah, that's what happens when you have, like, communists running your country, bro.
Like, you know, those are two things that you would need, you know, in a pandemic more than any other time, right? It's like you want some alcohol to, like, ease that stress a little bit, and you want the e-commerce companies to deliver shit to your door so you don't have to go out and be exposed, right? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, those regulations. Okay, so the e-commerce one has been eased. You can buy stuff online, and the alcohol ban will be lifted on Monday. But there's still some restriction. Like, you can't buy it on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. You buy it from Monday to Thursday, which is also ridiculous. I just view any form of regulation as just ridiculous. Yeah. So, sorry about that.
It's all good, man. I appreciate that. This was a ton of fun. I was excited to get to talk to you and hear your perspectives and get the lowdown on what's going on in South Africa.
I hope it was a good interview, man. Was it a good interview?
It was great. It was fantastic, man. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Thanks to Beki for joining me. Find him on Twitter at Mahlobo Beki, that's at MAHLOBO _ BHEKI, and I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Bitcoin Twitter. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. You can share this podcast with family and friends. You know, the bull is incoming. We can feel it. So get them on board, share some great Bitcoin content with them. Thanks again to Swan Bitcoin, swanbitcoin.com. for sponsoring this episode, and to the LTBN, the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network, for including the Citizen Bitcoin podcast in their feed alongside some other great Bitcoin-only pods. You can check out my merch shop at layer1btc.com. Click on Partners and then Citizen Bitcoin. Cool stuff there to check out. Some OPSEC-friendly Bitcoin-related gear. Really great stuff by designer and Bitcoiner Nick Ward. And check out the podcast I've created for Swan. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the Swan Signal podcast is an audio archive of our weekly live broadcasts. And like I said, it's a really unique format in the space, and I am really loving it. I'm loving moderating the discussions and just, you know, pairing up a couple of Bitcoiners for what become very unique discussions. So I think it's a great one to add to your Bitcoin podcast rotation. You can subscribe to it at swansignalpodcast.com. And if you have questions for me, please feel free to reach out. The best way is on Twitter. My DMs are open. I'm also on Telegram at Citizen Bitcoin. My email address is citizenbitcoin@pm.me. Love to hear from you all. Been having some conversations with listeners lately, and it's been super fun. Reach out. Let me know what's going on. Let me know if you have any questions. I'd love to chat. All right. That's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.